ladies and gentlemen, at an earlier start time than usual.
Welcome. It is Wednesday night, right?
It is Wednesday.
Wednesday, generational change. I'm Jen.
I'm Peter. And we are hearing the wonderful sounds of Lulu barking in the background.
Yeah, that's okay.
What is she up to?
That's okay. But what I want to make, I want to see if I can get it to work this time. Ooh. Because sometimes it does. It's weird. And it has to do with, there's something about, I'm going to get it to work. I feel it. It's going to happen for us. So when you make slides, sometimes it lets, see, and then it comes up perfectly fine. See what I'm saying? And then you just go in a select and now it's there. But what's great about it is you can slide through it without leaving the screen. You know what? The two of us are really have some tech issues here.
Well, we're trying our best.
Yeah, we have some issues.
So we obviously have to have this very important conversation because, as we mentioned, India Walton is somebody we think very highly of. And unfortunately, you know, is kind of broken to some degree based on what the Democratic Party has done to her and obviously how everything worked out with this election. And you want to talk about really stabbing somebody in the back. Remember, this is somebody who actually won the Democratic primary. Right. And then the Democratic Party decided, no, we'll just put him up as an independent candidate with millions and millions of dollars.
Can we somehow tie this into, because that article about Nancy Pelosi came out and I did not want to include it as news and amuse because it's not news. It's just nonsense. But basically where she is saying that the whole of democracy is at stake if we don't elect Democrats. And
yeah,
I would like to point out,
but that's the same thing that happens every election cycle with Democrats is they can't give you anything, but for God's sake, don't vote for the other guys because.
Right. Well, that's a problem. That's a problem.
And that is why we are having Shahid Buttar as another guest on our panel.
Blue won't do.
No. How could it?
It can't. But it's just interesting that I saw that article, Nancy. Our whole of democracy is dependent. Our democracy is dependent on the fact that people like you are corporate whores and have sold our government to the highest bidder, and people are starving and dying, and you're showing off gourmet ice cream. That's the problem with our democracy. It has nothing to do with electing Democrats.
Less Nancy Pelosi's, more Katie Porter.
Oh, God, I love her. I love her. She's just so good. I would have loved to see her litigate.
Actually. I love how she's built up so much credibility going after Republicans that when she finally does her whiteboard thing and goes right to the teeth of Medicare for All, it's like no one can actually fight her on it.
I just
it's
love
like,
it.
Yeah, you can't mess with her.
And do it's not pathetic that it needs a whiteboard. Like that she has to dumb it down so much for people and create
like. But that's the country we live in.
I know. It's just pathetic. It's pathetic to
me. If we had as we had the other day, a more robust public education system, maybe we wouldn't have that problem. But we all know that there are a lot of nuanced reasons for that. So we hope you guys are ready. This is going to be an excellent discussion because, again, a lot of progressives don't really know what to do these days. You know, it's good to see that you have people like Katie Porter stepping up and really hammering home why we need Medicare for All. But is there going to be any action taken? Hell, we can't even get the bill on the floor to remove stock trading from congressional representatives. I mean, things are bad.
We have a majority, and yet we now have, what, an $8 trillion war budget? I refuse to use defense budget anymore. That's ridiculous. It's an offense budget, and I find it incredibly offensive.
Yeah, you know, they're really trying to make sure that war in Ukraine doesn't end anytime soon.
Oh, no. And so, Nancy, what I'm thinking is if this is happening with Democrats, how are more Democrats the solution? And there's a lot of argument as to how to do this. I mean,
non-corporate.
Right. But we did it in the party because where we live, that's the only option.
Of course.
And that is the way it is, which is why we think it's really important to support people in nonpartisan races, ironically, like the mayor of Buffalo, which is a nonpartisan race. How is that possible?
She was the Democratic nominee for the mayor of Buffalo. She should be the mayor of Buffalo today. And in a more just world, we will make that so one day. India Walton, welcome back to Generational Change.
Oh. Hey.
Looking good, my friend.
Good to see you.
Absolutely.
Good to see you as well. How's the weather?
Well, you know, we are Florida. Lucky here this time of year. You know, it is nice.
This is actually the time of year where you do want to be in Florida.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, we're getting to where it'll be hot and sticky and disgusting. But
give it another month or two.
I was just up near you. I went up to visit my son. We flew into Rochester, and I went to go visit my son at Ithaca over the weekend. And it was a little nippy, I must say. It was a little nippy up there for me. So,
but at least you have nice nature surrounding
you. Oh, it's beautiful there. I love the country part of New York.
So we are going to go from one end of the country, New York, to the other end of the country, California. He is challenging the Queen herself, Nancy Pelosi. And we are certainly hopeful that with more of a robust operation and obviously not an endless amount of cannon fodder that one can be delivering, especially now. We are welcoming back Shahid Buttar to Generational Change.
Hi, Shahid.
So good to see you guys in India. It's such an honor to meet you. I'm a huge fan of your work.
Likewise.
I'm grateful to be among all of you.
Oh, I love to be sort of like a catalyst for meetings like that. We've had that before. It's very, very cool. But it's like another link in a web. You know, like, I really feel like that's really important. We do it with organizations. We do it with people. I think that that's one of the reasons that we like to do this.
Yeah. And one of the things that we've noticed, obviously, especially when it comes to, you know, the GOP, they're very loyal to each other. Like, they really are, you know, even with the people that they don't like, you know, people tend to forget that as hard as Hillary and the Dems went on Bernie in 2016, the GOP did the same thing to Trump. But as soon as he was the nominee, it's like, well, he's the man. You know, we're getting behind him. And the Democrats and especially progressives really have to understand that you cannot be searching for the only purity, in our opinion, that is needed in politics is whether or not you take corporate special interest money. Once you get past that, we can have these disagreements about A, B, and C. But if you're bought and paid for by the machine, that is all that matters. Whether it is running against the mayor of Buffalo or the congressional representative of San Francisco, whoever wants to jump in, I think this is a great place to start.
Andy, I'll defer to you.
No, I agree. I think that one of the hallmarks of democracy is that no one should feel like they're safe. Everyone deserves a challenge. Everyone, especially corporate Democrats, deserve primaries, especially in a time when we're seeing a Democratic majority in both houses and we're not getting anything done. So, you know, in the words of my sister AOC, all Democrats are not created equal. And this notion that progressives are ruining the party is a lie, is complete BS. And it's just like, give it back to us. If you want your neoliberal politics, you want to be owned by the lobbying corporations, then go on and be a Republican and let us fight for what the people really truly want and need.
Speak it. The only thing I'd add to that is that the pattern of the Democratic Party weaponizing itself against its own figureheads when they come from the left makes entirely too much sense if you consider it from a political economic perspective. In other words, if the goal of the party is to protect and promote capital, as it has been since the mid-90s, early 90s, I think there's it starts to fall into pretty predictable, sharp relief. And I think, if anything, the battle that we confront is one not only against the corporate co-optation of Congress, but it is capital ultimately and its representatives. I see a lot of people sometimes fall prey to the confusion that democracy exists somehow outside of capitalism. When we refer to capitalism, I don't just think of that as an economic system. It is the rule by capital of people. And in no way is it better exemplified in my mind than an oligarch co-opting one of the most progressive cities in the country and inflating her pockets for 35 years through insider trading while human rights fall by the wayside. And I see in voices like India's, like mine, like Alex Morse's, like Nina Turner's, voices willing to challenge the corporate establishment. Those, I don't want to say that we're the future, because we're not. We're just standing in. We're representing other people. We're representing our communities that have been abandoned for too long. And that's the only reason why I'm, frankly, you know, stepped forward in the first place. And it's the only reason I'm still here. And until our communities get what we need, I'm going to stay here. And I think that it's important to recognize what we are up against. And it is the corruption of a party, no less than capital and its interests.
Yeah, I was actually thinking that, India, when you were talking about the corporate Democrats, those two words should not exist. Like, that's an oxymoron in theory. Like, how is that a thing? Like, it's ridiculous. Like, and the fact that we have to present ourselves as a better non-corporate option is just, it's embarrassing, really. But I agree with you, Shahid. That's what kind of democracy is. I mean, we live in a very non-functioning republic. We've been non-functioning for so many years because our laws don't represent the will of our people. So if your laws don't represent the will of your people, then you're a non-functioning republic. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, like, you know, so I think it's very broken, but I know that the Democrats are not the only solution.
And that is obviously a very good segue because, as you know, the Queen herself will always do is give more cannon fodder for reasons why the system must change. Today, Speaker Pelosi comes out and says, if we allow the GOP to take over in the midterms, it's the end of democracy. It's like, well, you're not actually doing anything to prevent that from happening. So why should we be supporting you? And the question now becomes, especially as this movement continues to evolve, are more and more people at this point not buying this BS anymore? Because I'm starting to think people are getting a little hip to the game. What do you guys think?
I would thank you for whatever shift there might be here. The role of the independent media ecosystem in informing people about the narratives that I think to this day, unfortunately, fall under the bus. Most of the media sources that people consume, from newspapers of record to cable news programs, they spew corporate propaganda. And every turn, you know, there's a construction here in San Francisco of a supposed crime wave, and that's what everybody's talking about in the middle of an era when the amount of medical debt that Americans are bearing is growing to world historical proportions. Never in the history of humankind have people labored under this kind of burden. And you know, given the connection between medical debt and homelessness, there's a human rights crisis in plain sight unfolding before us, and people are distracted by these fabrications. And I see that, you know, true ultimately, not just among Republicans and their disinformation agents, but the Democrats too. As long as we're talking about cannon fodder, I just note that Pelosi today also said that Justice Thomas's decisions as to whether to recuse himself are up to him. And it just speaks to this, you know, the hypocrisy to say on the one hand that electing more Democrats are going to save democracy, while on the other hand, she does everything conceivable to hand it over to the agents of chaos. I think that it does grow overwhelming. And to the question of, are people waking up? We shall see. You know, the goal, the work that we're each doing, you and your podcast, us in our campaign, India in your campaign and organizing, you know, we're all ultimately trying to wake our neighbors up and help create a better future. And time will tell. We're certainly going to leave no stone unturned.
Yeah. India, your thoughts?
I think there's also something to be said about running an anti-campaign, right? I come from a school, I come from organizing, my background. So, you know, it's very difficult to win campaigns based on what you don't want. You kind of have to know what you do. So just saying that you have to vote Democrat because you don't want the GOP to take over is not enough. And we saw promises made that have been broken. And I don't think that people are falling for it anymore. I think that we are seeing the rise of the worker. I mean, I'm going to continue to say we're seeing workers go on strike. We're seeing the unionizing of Starbucks. We're seeing people become more politically active than ever before in my lifetime. And it excites me to know that we are instilling a sense of concern into the Democratic Party that we're the new majority.
Yeah.
The working majority.
Yeah, it's what we're working on. We're trying to. And then what gets very disheartening, though, are when I hear things like Chris Hedges, that his entire backlog of work and all of his has now been completely erased off of YouTube.
That was bananas. Can I just say how absolutely
I'm like a little bit freaking out about it. Like, that's like this is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. It's not like we're talking, and not that I agree with anybody being deplatformed, because I don't. But I find that really scary. But please, what were your thoughts on that?
Well, it's just striking to see that happening at the same time that Julian Assange is being prosecuted for publishing a military assassination of journalists in an ensuing cover-up. Like, this attack on, ultimately, it's not just the right of the press, it's the right of the people to know the facts. That's what's ultimately at stake. It's why we have in the First Amendment a protection for the right of the press. And it's the public is the ultimate beneficiary. And to see that and I don't even want to say interest because it's not an interest, and I don't even want to say a right because it's deeper than that. It's like a fundamental prerequisite of self-government, right? Whether it's a republic or a democracy, any nod in that direction requires people to have some opportunity to know what is simply happening. And that's very much on the chopping block. And frankly, even if a publisher were not being prosecuted in a bipartisan consensus to try to cover up military secrets, and even if a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist did still have access to major corporate platforms, the fact of the matter is the corporatization of the internet and the role of arbitrary tech platforms in deciding what is permissible speech and what is not, it threatens bedrock principles of democracy. And there's a hole in the bucket because the First Amendment only protects us against state action. But because the corporate platforms aren't state actors, we have no constitutional rights vis-a-vis them. This is a constitutional crisis because the values on which the values for which the First Amendment was crafted have become subject to the mercy of the marketplace. And nothing could be more dangerous to our aspirations as a people to govern ourselves, whatever our aspirations might be. I mean, like, you can fill in those blanks from, you know, universal healthcare to climate justice, what have you, but just the opportunity to govern ourselves in any rational way is what is at stake. And I do think that the assault on the freedom of the press is a big part of it, and deplatforming journalists and the role of corporate tech companies, content moderation, all of that. I would just throw out a word here. Antitrust reform, I think, is the solution. That's like a whole conversation in itself, but it's the way out of the bucket. If this lack of state action means the constitutional remedies aren't there, antitrust, those are the levers we need to be pulling. Most people in Washington still aren't paying attention.
Right. And I would argue that the majority of this problem goes back to a Democratic president. So that has gotten us into this mess is what I would argue. So, you know, that's a Bill Clinton problem.
Yeah. The 96 Telecom Act really has, there's legislation that gets passed over time that you don't actually feel until many years later. It takes time for it to, you know, build itself up. And, I think it's a good segue to a lot of the disconnect that I think we see politically speaking. There's so many virtue signals and I guess what you would call placating to a crowd when it's politically convenient to do so. But when India put out a viral tweet the other day talking about how the Democratic Party has essentially broken her and we have to look for other solutions, it's amazing how there was a significant amount of support, and especially from progressives. But the normie Democrats, the blue, no matter who, defend that blue line, if you will, by any means. The way that so many of the responses were so belittling, and in many instances racially charged. And I'm not one to call.
He's the last person to ever
say that. This is racist because everybody says everything is racist. But let me tell you, you're not fooling anybody with the little anecdotes and quotes that you're throwing out there when you're talking about India, because what you're basically talking about is you don't like this person leaving the reservation. That's how you're talking to her. And to deny it in any other way is to basically say, you're not a good team player. You're not a part of our group. Get lost. Don't ever come here again. Oh, and by the way, they don't know jack squat about the mayor of Buffalo, how he conducts business, how he has completely decimated that city for years. But because India dares to say that maybe the Democratic Party's not acting in the best way possible.
Just maybe.
Oh, their true feelings about Black Americans do tend to come out in moments like that. India, the floor is yours.
Yeah. I was just in a moment of, I'm going through a process of healing and processing all of the things that happened during the campaign. And now I am watching the New York State budget and our Democratic governor gut child services, but give $800 million to the Buffalo Bills to build a new stadium, right? And it's just like, these are not people who have the interests of the majority of us at heart. And Byron Brown, the mayor of Buffalo, is lock in step with a lot of these same sorts of actions, right? We don't have enough to provide basic needs and basic services and basic infrastructure, but we can give big tax breaks to large developers and large companies that come in with a handful of minimum wage jobs. It just doesn't make any sense to me. So in all of my inexperience and naivete, I guess, I just want to see people who are elected do what's practical and what's best and what makes sense for the majority of us. So, I mean, people can say whatever they want to. I'm not going anywhere, and I've been called much worse things by better people.
You better not be going anywhere. Can you give us a little bit more insight? You know, I'm a Giants fan, so I'm neutral in this.
It's always about sports.
But Jen's a Dolphin. But Jen's a Dolphins fan, so, you know.
I don't know which one of you was worse.
No. We just all agree that we hate the Patriots. I mean, I really think that if we could just all agree on that, and especially, look, I never had hate for the Bills, even though they were my same division. I never did. I always liked Jim Kelly. He and Dan were friends. Like, I never had hate for the Bills. All of my hate is reserved for the Patriots. I don't have any leftover hate. It's all there.
India's always going to hate me because it's Scott. Yeah, Scott Norwood. So that's never going to go away.
Wait, what? Shahid, what?
Once they blacklisted Colin Kaepernick, I just started boycotting the NFL. So, like, I'm sort of – I see it all in sort of the same vein as, you know, sort of the – maybe I'm being too dogmatic here, but the capitalist co-optation of all of our attentions.
No, it is. It's terrible and it's embarrassing. But I would like to say that my nostalgia for my team goes back to a time that wasn't like that. Right. And in fact, our stadium was the first privately built stadium. Our owners built their own stadium. They didn't have taxpayers do it. So it was a different time of how it was run. There were actual teams that had solidarity and they weren't just all about the money and free agency. Right. But I have a little bit of like for the Bills, and I did feel bad about the Scott Norwood incident. Nobody should have to come down, and should never come down to one person.
Well, Scott Norwood became Ray Finkel in a major movie, so you know how it works. Could you talk about what the actual details are? Because from a distance, it's $850 million in taxpayer dollars. Lord knows a lot of them are coming from the city of Buffalo, the surrounding suburbs, including Orchard Park. So what ultimately...
That's really pretty there, though.
I'm sure it's beautiful.
It's very lovely.
Why are the taxpayers footing the bill for a family that is worth $6 billion? Why are they not paying for this themselves? They're going to make it back anyway.
See, that's what I call welfare queens right there.
Yeah. Well, so it's a cobbling together of funding. I think about $250 million from the county of Erie and another 600 from the state. But the reason why is because they threatened to leave. they said, if you don't give us this money for a new stadium, we're going to up and leave. It's not going to be located in the city where it could be tied to a community benefits agreement that might actually benefit, you know, communities that have suffered for so long. It's going to be across the street from the old stadium in Orchard Park, which is a suburb of Buffalo that's 95% white. It's going to be smaller. It won't be a year-round multi-use facility. The uses will be very limited. There are lots of reasons why again, in my naive and inexperienced, just everyday average Jane opinion, say this is not a good deal. It's not a deal at all. It's a misuse of taxpayer money. And, you know, I think about how much housing we could build with $850 million. How much investments in education would go with that type of investment, how our infrastructure is crumbling, how we have lead water going into homes and paint that needs remediating, and neighborhoods that don't have access to fresh food. I can just think of better ways to spend it than on entertainment. And you see my jewelry, right?
I did. I noticed it.
I'm a Bills fan through and through. Former season ticket holder, you know, I'll go out and brave the 20 degree single digit temperatures to root for my team. But at the end of the day, I care more about my people than I do about football.
I think that it all just goes to our priorities and how we glorify sports, and everything is about
sports. It's not even glorifying sports. It's glorifying the rich.
Well, it is, but if you didn't have people convinced how important having a sports team was in a town, like if that wasn't a really important economic thing, and we could probably dig into, like, at some point, how economically beneficial it is to a town and to what part of that town.
Usually because, a lot less so than they claim, right? I mean, this is the same thing comes up in the Olympic construction.
Oh, Olympics. Every time it goes somewhere,
you have mass displacement to create these one-time use infrastructure projects. If I can just throw in one thing here, India, it's the second time it came up, so I just want to give you props for whatever that you described it as naivete. And to me, it's the vision to see through the corruption of what is, to envision what can be. And I just want to give you props for seeing it. And even if you feel like you were made into a punching bag for seeing it, it's recognized. That is exactly what leadership is. And it's why, I mean, you have so much support from so many people around the country. You saw in your example what a bold challenge to corruption looks like. And
I appreciate that. Thank you.
As you're talking about healing, and I just want you to, you know, feel that support and love from the rest of us, because we might not be there on the ground with you, but there are a lot of people around the country, maybe the world, who are inspired by what you did.
That means a lot. Thank you.
So Shahid, now that you have also yourself been somewhat of a punching bag for a few election cycles, and you're doing this again, and it's like, you, when do you sort of heal? Like, I've said to him many times, like, I'm still just getting back to normal after 20 and what that felt like. So, you know, how do you just go right back into this again?
Yeah, that's it. I appreciate the question. In some respects, I feel like I haven't had a choice, if only because, you know, Pelosi continues to steamroll the agenda that our communities need. So I sort of see the corruption that I originally ran to confront just forced into my face constantly. So I wasn't driven to this by some sort of sense of wanting to build a career. It was outrage at a set of circumstances that have only grown worse. So that's kind of why I'm still here. A couple of thoughts just to your question, and I do appreciate it. You know, when I was a particular young man here in San Francisco, Eric Curry, who was until recently also running against Pelosi alongside me, just withdrew from the race a few weeks ago and endorsed our campaign. And one of the things he said to me, he's a young mixed race gay man, and he said to me, I don't think I could take what they did to you. And, you know, that really for me doubly reinforced my commitment, because if it was just about me, maybe I would have taken my marbles and go home. But at the end of the day, I see all the things that are implicated. And when I ran against the corruption of the Democratic establishment, it was mostly its corruption in Washington that animated me and motivated me. And then to discover its corruption in San Francisco, and then to discover this message that young men of color are internalizing, if I don't stand here and flip that script, made me realize that it's more than just a congressional seat ultimately that I'm fighting for. And when I see the white supremacy, the racism, the Islamophobia within the Democratic establishment, and the way that the establishment is willing to weaponize it. And when I say establishment, I should be clear here. It's not just the corporate establishment. Right here in San Francisco, I'm very grateful that what we might describe as a left wing has a toehold in local city politics, and it is just as corrupt in exactly the same way. And I wish this were simply ideological, but at the end of the day, this is institutional white supremacy, which is to say it's power defending itself. And, you know, if only it were ideologically coherent, it might make it make some sense. Maybe that would make it easier to take. You know, but that's not the world we live in. And at the end of the day, people have interests and they're crass and craven about promoting them. And those of us who are here for principles and have been fighting for these principles for decades, we don't really have a choice but to fight through that muck to get to the point where we can actually pass and implement better policies on behalf of our communities, policies that will center human needs and working families instead of the oligarchs and the billionaires that are continuing to fleece all of us.
I think it goes without saying that being in New York and California, a big issue that we advocate for is universal health care, Medicare for all. Of course, New York has the New York Health Act and California has CalCare.
We have nothing.
Yeah, we're Florida. We're screwed. So, you know,
just going to say
that's just
it is like the fact that
you got Ron DeSantis. So it's like worse than merely that. Right. I mean,
oh, we're never having that. We'll be underwater long before there's health.
You better say, hey, Shahid, you better start calling him President DeSantis pretty soon. That's all I got to say.
That's what's coming. And if you want to know what's even scarier is the rumors of Rick Scott being interested in that office, because that actually almost makes me be willing to campaign for Ron DeSantis.
I don't think he can fake populism.
I don't know, but Rick Scott scares the crap out of me.
Yeah, he's definitely one of the worst I've ever seen.
He's Voldemort.
You guys... You haven't seen Rick Scott on like a national scale the way that DeSantis is out there. I mean, he makes DeSantis look appealing. Like, that's how bad he is.
Anyway.
So, I mean, it goes without saying that if we could have universal health care, it's going to be very hard to fight for it through Capitol Hill. But if we are able to do something at the state level, we saw what happened recently with, you know, Representative Kalra's bill. Couldn't even make it out of committee. We all know that there's probably a lot of dirty stuff that goes on in Sacramento.
We need to have him back on and find out what happened.
Yeah, just like there is in Albany. So the question now becomes, Is it ultimately a statewide ballot initiative, Shahid, that you would be pushing for in California? And the same would be true for the New York Health Act, which I personally think has more juice, Indy. I think that there really is a growing sense of support for that, especially because of the progressive bastion that is growing in New York City and the way that that can spread throughout the rest of the state. So what do you guys think in regards to healthcare and how we ultimately push it now? Because you are in the two states of most consequence regarding that issue.
In California, the fate of CalCare really represented the weakness of state legislative reforms that allow opacity. So in other words, there have been more than one time that I've worked on a state bill that's died in the state assembly because they didn't vote on it. And the idea that measures can die without votes is a real problem because you can't actually point the finger at anyone. And I think this is one of Asha's frustrations when his bill went down, is that nobody was willing to stand against it, right? And so this is sort of like a way democracies die. Unfortunately, I think ballot measures and propositions are prone to a separate set of demagogueries, particularly that you can basically buy victory, and that's what usually happens with them. And so anything that puts a corporate interest on the proposition ballot, usually we lose to corporate interests because they have infinite pockets. And so like that's a really scary way to go as well. One reason I'm running for Congress is that I would frankly like to move universal health care at the federal level, precisely because the risk pool within states is not as large as it is within the federal government. And so the economic impacts of universal health care will be most observable. They'll be most obvious. They'll be the hardest to overlook if we do it at the federal level. I recognize the opportunity in the states to move first, and I support state-based initiatives to work around the federal logjam. I do fear a challenge in translating and replicating the success in moving Romney's plan into the ACA. The vision with state-based universal healthcare plans is that we could do the same thing, establish a success case at a state level, translate it then to Washington. That whole vision presumes that Washington is in any way well-intentioned or would respond to empirical evidence of efficacy at the state level. But I think we all know that it's, you know, if it's different degrees and brands of corruption, I don't think proving efficacy at the state level, frankly, matters much. So again, that just brings me back to needing to end the corruption in Washington. But, you know, I love Ash Kalra. I love that bill. I'd love to see states move forward. And I think we have to fight for it on all fronts, ultimately.
Yeah, I remain hopeful that we'll see some courage from our state legislature this year and move on the New York Health Act. It's gaining momentum. I think the more that we are able to run mass education campaigns and allow people to know what the New York Health Act is and is not, you know, folks who belong to unions who have decent health benefits are not going to suffer as a result of this. But we are seeing coverage for all likely to pass. So, you know, I think that taking it one step at a time and just continuing to put the pressure on from the grassroots level is going to be key to getting this thing done. But I do maintain faith in our legislature to get it done.
Yeah.
We have to talk about unions. This is an unavoidable topic at this point. We had a conversation with a gentleman the other day who talked about the truth about the teachers' union and what they fight for versus what they should be fighting for. Teachers fight for other teachers, not for students. When I heard that, it really hit hard. But it speaks more so not just to Ms. Weingarten, but probably a problem that exists with a lot of unions today. No greater example of that was after, India, you won your primary. One of the local unions still backed Mr. Brown in the general election. It was one of the most despicable displays of corporatocracy I've ever seen. And that, probably as much as anything that occurred after you won the primary, was the biggest slap in the face. You knew what corporate interests were going to do, but this idea that unions, which is supposed to be about labor, we're going to get behind this defeated mayor because they are just as corrupt, is a big problem. Now, it's not a question of the rank and file, because most of the rank and file agrees with what we're trying to do. But the leadership is a whole other animal. So yeah. If you guys can talk about what that experience has been like, Shahid, I'm sure you can have plenty to talk about, because San Francisco used to be a union town, but it certainly isn't the one it used to be. And so whoever wants to jump in, obviously what both of you have gone through regarding the differences between unions versus labor, I think is very, very distinct. I mean, because we dealt with that down here.
Yeah. Like I'm always pro labor. I'm not necessarily pro union. And it really depends on who's running that union. And we have it here. It's really bad. Shahid, I'm sure you could talk about that at your local level, but like ours is, they're just in bed with Debbie because they're in bed with Debbie. They're not looking out for what's in the best interest of workers. Like that's just the political corruption at the top of the union is really no different than it is in our legislature.
We met a union member on election day, or it was like close to election day, and he showed up with his AFL-CIO pamphlet and says, I just do what my boss
tells me. Just follow the card. Yeah.
There were people who had moved up the ranks in the union that I fought side by side with, that I was like on picket lines together, on long bus rides to Albany with, who know who I am, who know that I'm pro-labor, that who know that I'm pro-worker, who then went out and said India is anti-union. We had an incident where the collective bargaining agreement for our print shop expired. So rather than fraudulently putting the union bug on lit where there was no agreement, we just left it off because we weren't sure what was going on. And they were like, look, she's anti-union. She's anti-union. None of that is true. But again, like this is about the maintenance of power and control and really keeping the little guy down. And these are things that I experienced both as a union member, you know, right in the shops, and as a person who was running for office. So, the solution, I have no idea.
That's what I was going to say. What's the answer, Shahid? You know.
I have ideas here. So first, again, I'm just so sorry that happened to you, India. To see labor turned on itself by union leadership serving the corporate bosses before the rank and file is a particular kind of disgusting and betrayal. And I've certainly encountered it here too. Every labor union in San Francisco. And just to be clear, this was the site of a general strike in 1934, right? So like, all of the unions banding together to fight Wall Street together. And not a single one of them could even be bothered to have any kind of process before deciding to endorse the corporate Speaker of the House, who blocks universal health care, who blocks the federal minimum wage from increasing, and who at the time opposed the Protecting Right to Organize Act. And I'm glad to have frankly dragged her into supporting it after winning the primary in 2020. But to see unions become so complicit in their own erosion at the hands of these corporate bosses. And Pelosi's kind of unique because she's not just a corporate Speaker of the House, but she's an oligarch herself, right? And then when you think about congressional insider trading and the stakes that oligarchs take, I mean, she's an owner of some of these corporations, at least in, you know, infinitesimal microcosm as well. The point here I'd really want to drive home, and this is I'll just make this sort of clear in a case study. SEIU comes to mind, Service Employees International Union. Put in solidarity with them for years, been on picket lines with them, stood
great
around.
Locals.
Yeah.
Great locals.
Yeah.
Great locals. Absolutely. And here in not just San Francisco, but California, the statewide affiliate endorsed Nancy Pelosi a few weeks ago without a debate, without a process of any kind, even transparent to its rank and file. And so several of its members, several SEIU members who support our campaign, came to our campaign and said, you know, we think this is BS. We really want you in the meeting where they're going to announce Pelosi's endorsement, because she won't debate me and she hasn't debated anyone in 35 years. But these union members were like, we'd at least like to see a debate within the union, right? So they get me in the Zoom. Of course, they won't let me speak, so there's no debate. But I had a chance to post something in the chat before they disabled it. And ultimately, you know, posted to social media Pelosi's face and those of the SEIU leaders as they're reading the chat that we posted about how SEIU members deserve an opportunity, rank and file deserve an opportunity to influence how their collective weight is asserted politically. And I want to go back to an earlier point in the conversation. I am so thrilled by the wave of workplace organizing that is happening around the country. Many of our supporters are active in it as rank and file, organizing their respective workplaces. And I see in that enormous promise, particularly in terms of collective bargaining outcomes and the material conditions for the working class. And the battle for workplace democracy extends beyond the workplace into our unions, because when unions do things like endorse corporate incumbents without debates that their rank and file can influence, we just end up trading one locus of domination for another. And corruption rears its head in many forms. And I particularly appreciate how you distinguish between labor and unions. And I think all of us here are very pro-labor. We're all committed to labor, even when unions have not been. And in terms of solutions, I think the solution is for rank and file union members to contest elections within their unions and to make these issues from within. I've talked to many staff people at many unions who have lamented this whole dynamic we're describing. And they say, we can't do anything about this because we're staff. The only people who can do anything about this are members. Only rank and file union members have the opportunity to displace corrupt leadership. And it frankly falls to them to do so. It's incumbent on them. And I exhort everyone in a union to fight that battle internally to make sure that your union is answering to the rank and file and not that the rank and file's weight is being thrown around by leadership ultimately serving its own interests.
And the best example was the 2016 primary. I mean, it really was a watershed moment. Anytime the rank and file were allowed to vote on the union endorsement, they endorsed Bernie every single time. Whenever it was a board decision, and the first one that kind of set the precedent, unfortunately, was the teachers union, because Randy Weingarten is the dictator of that organization, they endorsed Hillary. And that kind of set the precedent, unfortunately. And while most of the rank and file, I have no doubt, agree with what we're trying to do here, and especially in a state like Florida, when you're a right-to-work state, forget it. People are not going to step out of line. And we have no problem saying the name, Dan Reynolds.
He is
the head of the Broward County AFL-CIO. And he is lord and manor of this whole operation. He has been with Debbie for 25 years. And, you know, to hell with what workers need. It's all about what the guy who's been in, you know, union politics for 40 years or more, maybe, is of interest to them. And to the rest, as union, you know, as labor power continue, well, again, union power continues to die. Labor power is on the way up. And the question will become, how do people feel about that? You know, forming a union is important, but how the union is managed may be even more important. And I hope that's something that a lot of the, you know, whether it is, again, the watershed moment of the Starbucks workers in Buffalo forming the union, we can only hope that the precedent is set that, hey, if we're going to do this right, this has to be more of a co-op type situation. Would you guys agree?
Yep. And you have to continue to organize. Organizing never stops after you win. That is when the real work actually begins. There always has to be accountability. There always has to be organizing. There always has to be development and skill development of the next generation of leaders.
Yeah, we're fortunate. Right now, we have two Starbucks that are in our little location that are scheduled to have their vote and that are really working it. And it's very exciting. And one of them is in Hialeah, which I don't know if you guys are familiar with, but it's an extremely Cuban, very red, not normally the idea of union to them is way socialist. Like this would normally be the last place you would expect that. And yet it's going really well there. So like for us, that's a big deal to have that area be like accepting and supportive of a union. I mean, it's a big deal. For us,
it's a big deal anywhere that workers have an opportunity to band together, because the difference between being in a union and not is the difference between being subject to the vagaries of the marketplace by yourself against the combined weight of Wall Street versus having other people who have your back. It is literally that simple. And within the context of the workplace relationship, you know, beyond wage bargaining, you know, collective wage determinations, you know, I particularly think about workplace safety as an area where unions play a really crucial and overlooked role, because in non-unionized workplaces, like Hollywood, for instance, you know, someone died on a film set because there weren't unionized workers there who knew how to use the props. And like unionization ensures, you know, much more than just the opportunity to be paid a living wage. It also relates, you know, it helps people get home at night. And I think that's a huge difference in the lives for the people who have the opportunity to participate in unions and not. And I just, as long as we're on it, I just want to shout out the Protecting Right to Organize Act, which has not yet passed the Senate.
Yeah.
It, you know, workplace organizing fights at the moment happen on a tilted field, and a tilted field very much tilted in favor of the bosses. And the PRO Act would level that playing field and make it easier to form unions. It would make it so that there would be actual penalties when labor rights are violated. At the moment, they tend to be after the fact, a day late and a dollar short. So even the meager labor rights that the NLRB has recognized tend not to be meaningfully enforceable at the time when they when they would be most helpful. So the PRO Act would be revolutionary. And, you know, for people whose senators perhaps might not have yet supported it, I would encourage them to, you know, write a letter with your neighbors.
Yeah. Well, we're a lost cause. I mean, we have Marco Rubio and Rick Scott. So we're not, that's just.
You just got to replace them. That's the.
And if our state isn't backwards enough, with all due respect to Mr. Crist and Ms. Fried, the strongest candidate, if we're just being objective in our state, is Val Demings, and she's running for the wrong seat. And if she was running against DeSantis, I think it would be a much more interesting race. But because she's running against Rubio, which
no
is
chance.
Very quiet, no one's talking about that.
No, race. No chance.
So doesn't really have the opportunity to kind of make that splash. But in Florida, we are Florida, and we, of course, always manage to make everything wrong.
Yeah, nobody here is going to support the PRO Act. Our congresswoman didn't support, she was trying to fast track the TPP, and yet our AFL-CIO endorses her without even giving us a screening. So
what? Really?
Yeah. They didn't even give us a screening. But my curiosity about that, and I've never been in a union, but I'd like to think that if I were in a union and my union did that in a violation of its own bylaws, which it is a violation of their own bylaws, I would find that really annoying, and I would probably say something about that.
And that was a huge difference between Jen's campaign versus Canova's campaign, because Canova was granted a screening. And the reason I believe that Jen was not granted a screening, we didn't raise a boatload of money. We raised $400,000. We did a pretty good job, all things considered. But I think the reason she wasn't granted a screening is because they actually thought she could win. I thought that Canova was granted a screening because they always assumed Debbie would find a way to win. And ultimately she did. In this instance, I always thought that it was like, do not give this woman air under any circumstances, because people like Jen. People are not voting for Jen because they hate Debbie. They're voting for Jen because they think she'd be a good representative. That is a dangerous animal. And one thing that a lot of people in politics really need to understand when it comes to, you know, certain races that you want to run against, oh, I'm running against this, that, and the other person. It doesn't matter. If you're a better candidate and you're really strong, it will shine through. You know, you happen to both be in two states that have some really awesome federal representation. On the East Coast, you currently have AOC, Jamal Bowman, and Mondaire Jones in particular that stand out in terms of their non-corporate power and the growth that's coming as a result of that. And of course, in California, you have some really strong representatives led, of course, by Katie Porter, Ro Khanna, and you can also say Barbara Lee. So I would definitely say when you have that type of fallback, you know, unfortunately in Florida,
we have nobody.
We don't have that.
Nobody.
So we're kind of up that creek without a paddle.
We don't have a single federal representative.
Now that Ted Deutsch is retired, we don't have any federal representatives in Florida that support Medicare for all. So that's
Frederica Wilson said she did.
Okay. All right.
Well, particularly ironic in a state where I gather your population is disproportionately aging, right? So people would really benefit from Medicare for all in that state.
Well, except a lot of older people, the mentality is I got mine, you wait for yours, and it's not a priority for them. And this fascinates my parents. They live in like an older community, and my mom just cannot wrap her head around how people, just because they get, it's just not a priority for them.
Yeah.
They have their Medicare. Yeah. So it's not their concern.
I hate to say it, but we really can't use our state as a barometer. We just can't.
No,
it's a state that's extremely transient. New York and California are not. California maybe a little bit, but you know, this is just a state where people are constantly coming in and out. They're also coming in now because as much as people don't like a governor, there are people who are like, you thought Trump support was rabid. This guy's a god now to a lot of people. Because of the way that he ultimately chose to do COVID. And it's the wild, wild west down here.
He's a very smart politician.
He is. That's one thing I would never, one thing you can't say about DeSantis, that is the big difference between him and Trump. His political instincts are really sharp, like really sharp.
It's kind of scary.
He will not step in ish. That he will not do. He'll make mistakes and he'll do really stupid stuff at times. But in terms of actually hurting his support from the GOP as well as independents, the one thing I do give him credit for, he doesn't care about winning any Democratic voters.
Nope.
Because he doesn't need them.
The irony here is I think you just kind of nailed it. I was going to juxtapose that mode of governance, which is sort of unapologetic with respect to the base, with the prevarication that we see among corporate Democrats. And I'm thinking right now about the one of the upcoming elections that I'm excited about is Jessica Cisneros is in Texas.
Yes.
Against yeah. Henry Cuellar in May 24th, I think. And Cuellar was endorsed by Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi is a powerful woman. She's a Speaker of the House, and she endorsed a sitting member of Congress who is under investigation by the FBI and one of the few anti-choice incumbents in Congress. And so how can you square being a powerful woman leader of a branch of government and supporting someone who denies women the right to determine what to do with their bodies? I just find that so blatantly hypocritical. And I mean, words fail me. I just hope that people understand their interests and look past the theater enough to recognize in the positions that they take who is standing with them and who is not. This is one of the reasons that debates are so crucial for voters and democracy, because without debates, people don't get to hear these contrasts ever. You know, they just end up seeing somebody kneeling in kente cloth and they're like, "Woo, she's with us." And like, you know, it's deeper than that. And
the images don't convey the full story. We're Shahid one of these times. We do a story time occasionally, and one of them is called The Kente Cloth Tales, an anthology of tone deaf. And so it doesn't have to just be her, but that's now our banner for complete tone deafness is the Kente Cloth Tales.
Nice.
piece of work.
One of the places I think is, if not the place to really wind down the conversation, is we're in a situation right now where a lot of people are feeling nihilistic. They don't really believe in the system. They think it's completely corrupted.
Certainly partisan politics, more specifically.
Absolutely. One thing I give both of you credit for is you don't get marred down in the game of gotcha by like dunking on GOPers. It's like there is no added value to that. The only thing you're going to actually end up doing is losing support as a result, because that's not the type of partisanship people are looking for. If you have a GOP representative who is deliberately hurting his representatives as a result of whatever it is he could be doing, let's say voting against healthcare, voting against the environment, you know, it's no different. If somebody were to say, you know, why do you support a clean energy initiative? I give them a very simple response. If you had to choose between a fracking well and a solar field in your backyard, which one are you going to pick? Because this is not a debate anymore. Like you like to say, this is like debating flat earthers on
certain
issues.
Well, that's the thing. Like that's when you say debates are important. And I think a lot of times they are so people can see. But there's certain things that are just, I'm sorry, I'm not debating you about healthcare anymore. Just like I'm not going to debate you about teaching creationism in my school and a whole bunch of other things. We, the civilized people, are past that discussion at this point. And I don't like giving certain things credibility. That's my problem with that. And
I hear that. I think we're operating from different baselines, because here you're talking about sort of contested cultural questions that like science resolves. I'm just talking about corrupt incumbents who duck debates and weave personalities. And so people don't even know what they stand for, you know, and there it's not even so, you know, as much as I do think that the debate, for instance, over climate change has been long settled, it's not like Congress is paying a lick of attention, right? And I even like take it a step further. There's this discourse that like Don't Look Up was just nominated for a bunch of, and I'm so glad that in the entertainment sphere, people are talking about it. But you know, even in the entertainment sphere, it's not like we're actually talking about nationalizing the fossil fuel industry. No one in Congress has proposed that policy. And I proposed that policy. And you know, I'll see all these organizations talk about climate justice and they'll do actions, but they're not around policy. And like when you have policy that actually addresses the crisis, no one hears about it. The journalists who talk about climate change won't cover those campaigns. It's not being represented in Congress. Okay, great. Now we're talking about movies about climate change, but can we get to the policies, please, that we'll actually do something about it?
And that's why this is such a significant issue now, because as much as there is this nihilism, and I go back to, you know, how many people came to India's defense as we did, you know, regarding that tweet about how the Democratic Party is literally going to, they would rather destroy themselves than, you know, give in to this movement that's growing day by day. But the way I see it, I'd like to think that over the last 5 years, as much as we know how corrupt the system is, I think we're getting a lot sharper about how the game is played and we're not falling for the same BS. I mean, there's always going to be people that will, but I think people are getting a lot more hip to what needs to be done. I think we're becoming a little bit more focused and centralized on what we need to do. How do you guys see it, India?
I do think that we're becoming more focused. And I also think that people, you know, the average voters are beginning to see who they can trust I think in the case of Buffalo, we had a really solid ground game and people were able to have one-on-one interactions. And that is a lot more meaningful than what they're consuming in mainstream media or what it says on the glossy flyer. To actually know one another is super important.
I agree. And I think people recognize when you see the difference between the crises that the incumbents are engineering and the vision that we propose as an alternative, and then you see who gets attacked, I think people start to put together, you know, who are the truth tellers, who's standing with our communities, and who is not. I see it particularly baldly demonstrated in this debate over congressional insider trading, because it's just so obvious who's fighting for who and who's fighting to fill their pockets. And I do think of that as one of the indications that people are wising up. You know, that's been a scandal in plain sight for decades. It's not like a new phenomenon. And frankly, the results of those conflicts of interest and divided loyalties have infected every area of federal policymaking for the last two generations, from housing to healthcare, militarism, you name it, right? So the idea that now finally people are paying attention to that and the conflicts of interest that it invites and entrenches to allow policymakers to own stocks, I think that's an indication that people are starting to wake up and see through some of the smoke in the mirrors. And I'm looking forward to what it looks like when enough people look through those smoke and mirrors to make different collective choices at the ballot box.
I can't help but feel bad about Martha Stewart when we talk about this, because I feel like she had to go do time and Nancy Pelosi just gets to sit there and talk about insider trading like it's just no big deal. Our congresswoman actually made the single greatest profit on any single purchase based on insider knowledge about the war in Ukraine.
And guess what she decided to invest $45,000 in? Fracking.
It's a drilling company. And she made, it was like, she got like a 60-something percent return over 3 months based on an investment she made in January regarding knowledge on Russia invading Ukraine.
That's great work if you can get it. Jesus. Yeah, and then Nancy Pelosi says, we're capitalists. That's just the way it is. It's not a free market at all when people are trading inside information. And if I may, like, I think we're focusing now on the corruption of the marketplace. I'm always keen to focus on the corruption of the policymaking process, because it's not just their ill-gotten gains in the marketplace. Yeah. They're steering policy outcomes to favor their interests.
Yeah.
And disclosure doesn't fix that. You know, the pretense that the Stock Act is enough, it's a joke. Every example of this indicates, I'm taken back to, I think it was 6-7 years ago, CBS did a whole special on Nancy Pelosi and the Visa IPO. And while she's investing in the initial public offering before available to the public of Visa, she's kneecapping proposed credit market regulations that would favor consumers and people who have credit card debt. And this is just like one among any number of examples of this corruption in plain sight. And it's why, frankly, I'm grateful again for programs like yours and Voices Like India's. Thank you so much for making me feel less alone in the world. I appreciate it.
Yeah. I think we all know we need each other. And one thing I would like to ask as we conclude, not necessarily whether it would have made a difference between winning and losing this previous race, but what is one thing that, if you could change, you think would have made a significant difference in the outcome and could potentially be seen as something, should you currently running or choose to run again, that you think would serve you well?
I would have gone full scorched earth. You know, I came out knowing that I wasn't going to have the support of the establishment Dems. And after I won the primary, I sort of went back to try and bring everyone in, all the while they were undermining the campaign and taking back information and just doing all kinds of, I should have just rolled with my team, rolled with the Working Families Party and did what we had to do and brought home the victory. So, you know, lesson learned.
That's the lesson learned. But, you know, you were actually thinking of it like a reasonable person. What would a reasonable thing to do would be to work together with the party that you just won the primary for. See, that's what a reasonable person would do.
Well, you know, we're reasonable people here. And I think if India had won the nomination, I certainly would have supported her. That's why I'm not a Democrat.
I know. Well,
I would echo that actually and take a similar line. I burned a lot of time in Democratic clubs in San Francisco looking for support from groups and communities that were, despite their stated interests, ultimately beholden to Pelosi and willing to dive into the muck to defend her. And, you know, I recognize that, just like India was saying, you know, you got to focus on where the support is at and frankly, write off parts of the, this is guidance to other candidates, write off the parts of the establishment that are entrenched, because You can burn a lot of time trying to curry favor with people who are already entrenched, or you can spend that time finding other people to push them out of the way. And I'm very clear as to where to focus my, you know, the balance of my time.
Jen's got something to say.
Oh, I said that to him from the very beginning when we started the campaign. He was of the got to go to the Dem clubs, got to go schmoozy with the people, got to go do all that. And I said to him many times, it's not going to serve us one way or the other. They, even the ones that like me are not going to step out of line. It doesn't even matter. And I, my thought about it is it's unfortunate we have to run as a Democrat here, but the way to win is never going to be through that party. It's only going to be around them. Like, we actually have to work around. It's ridiculous, yes. But that's the way it is. Like, to me, every time I went to one of those meetings, not only do I think it was damaging to my brain cells, but I'm pretty sure it made no impact whatsoever. And I also feel like it kind of gives credence and credibility to their bullshit. Our state party is sponsored by Walmart and Big Sugar. So if I'm participating with that, then I'm sort of part of that. And everything I stand for is against that. So why would I, like, I wouldn't pay to go to a function for them when that's where they get their money from. Like, so how, it just doesn't serve anything I'm trying to do to affiliate with them in any way. I think it's a complete waste of time.
And I've always maintained that it's all about meeting the people. As far as the leadership, the people that that's are knee deep in the party. Yeah. You're not going to convince them because, frankly, with all due respect, most of them are complete cowards. You both know that. They may say, and listen, I am sure both of you have had very high up people in the party who have pulled you aside and said off the record, I am voting for you. I support you. I can't do it publicly.
And correct.
That's right. Funny. And that yeah. is the, that is the, that, that is the pyramid scheme that we are. This whole country.
Complete cuckdom is yeah, what it is.
No, this, but the whole system is a pyramid scheme. If you think about it, it's almost like if one of the people from the bottom somehow got knocked out of the foundation, the whole thing's going to collapse. Everyone knows that when one part is bought off, the other part is bought off with it. If labor is a problem, then the establishment is a problem. If the Chamber of Commerce is a problem, then the hospitals are a problem. Everything finds a way to become interconnected like this really nasty web of stuff. And unfortunately, in Democratic Party politics in particular, it tends to be extremely entrenched. It tends to be very, it's much more generational. The GOP is consistent and changes more often because they are pro-corporate all the way. They don't have this influx, which would be interesting to see. Because the one thing that enough libertarians are at least willing to admit is they hate the corruption too. But we don't see enough of them willing to run within the party without corporate money. Then we'll see just how powerful the GOP really is regarding that particular element that we haven't seen yet. Because to me, this really is the issue of our time, is dealing with the corporate special interest control of our government. Mm-hmm. And it happens local, state, and federal. It's not like we can just go and chase some seat down somewhere else and think, okay, this will solve the problem. And there's probably in New York, for example, in California, you could probably run for the state house and end up in Sacramento and Albany, and you'll probably be in a non-corrupted situation. But there will always be something overhead that will say, okay, you'll be able to make some changes locally. But once it gets involved with serious policymaking, oh, we'll cut it off at the knees if it ever has a chance to pass.
Well, we talked about that even half an hour ago with Ash Kalra's CalCare bill. That's almost exactly, you just described exactly what happened. You know, thoughtful person. He came up, if I remember correctly, Ash was a public defender before he became an yeah. assembly member, you know, served yeah. his community in a bunch of different ways, brings forth this visionary bill. It's got support across the state. And what happens? Dies without a vote in the assembly at the 11th hour. It's just like exactly to the saga that you're describing.
Yeah.
And I think that that's where we have to have these conversations. And we know who the people are that are in the so-called progressive movement that are not going to serve what we're trying to do here. If we can all collectively agree that the issue of our time is corporate special interest money in our politics, and we have to be looking at everybody as a potential ally who agrees that this is the issue of our time, then that's the bottom line. People can
scare there. I would push back there, but that's a whole other conversation. There's points of zones of disagree of agreement.
Yes, of course. Within reason. There's always, yeah, no, I agree. There's always going to be that line. But overwhelmingly, I think people are good. And I think they want better for this country. I think they know things are bad. I think that there is a thing, as we like to talk about in the Democratic Party, called sanctimony, which really turns people off.
They're so elitist. They come off as so elitist. They just do. It's disgusting. Sometimes, and it's beyond just like kente cloth tails, right? Like it's this level of academic elitism that just, it's suffocating. And I could see how that really turns off people. So anybody who's sort of like in the middle, which even though policy wise, sure, you would be a Democrat. I mean, that's actually like right of center, but like they're so disgusted with that liberal elitism that they just, it's really, it's suffocating. Do you know that? Have you noticed that?
I mean, you know, the fact that the term woke has become an insult, right. You know, I say a lot of times to my people, we can't exclude people with our language. Just say what it is that you mean to say. It doesn't have to be this long, drawn out, intellectual, over intellectualized debate. Just say the thing and move on with it. So, like, definitely, it tends to be overly academic at times.
And I would say I see it because I resemble that remark to some extent. And like, I work against it. I just like talk how I think. But like, I recognize that it's, you know, that language can be exclusive. And so I think, you know, if anything, I get dinged for sounding like some of those people, though the challenge for me is it's like, you know, I went to these elite institutions, I see through the smoke and mirrors because I studied all this stuff. And so I speak like them, but I deconstruct it all. So I hope to be in that respect, almost like a, you know, like not a class traitor because I'm not part of their class by any means. You know, I'm a working class person with, you know, student debt, but like, I can speak their language and I got trained at their institution. So I can like get behind that curtain. And so because I got behind that curtain, I think a lot of people, you know, think of me as privileged because I speak like them. So I get it in a weird way there. But in my mind, the sanctimoniousness really comes down to when you see it's this pattern we're talking about with corporate Democrats pretending to stand for communities while undermining their interests. Here in San Francisco, the LGBTQ community is a political kingmaker. And it tends to be one of the more moderate conservative voices in our city's body politics. And I fought for gay rights before they were popular. My client was actually in India's neck of the woods. He was the mayor of New Paltz in the Hudson Valley at the time, Jason West. And he was the only public official in the country who was subjected to criminal prosecution for standing in solidarity with the right of consenting adults to marry a partner of their choice. And Pelosi did not show up for that fight for a decade until after we were in court. And she gets credit for fighting for AIDS research in a previous era. And I give her credit for that. But, you know, when we were fighting for the rights of gay people to have families, she was nowhere to be seen with all the power and privilege of the Speaker of the House. And yet she relies on that community to send her back to Congress every 2 years. And, you know, that's the sanctimonious I see when people wrap themselves in these cultural affinities, but they don't show up on the policies. You know, or when they pander to communities of color without showing up for our community's interests.
Let's talk more action. That's exactly what we need. And
if I may, just on that, and I'll shut up after this. Here in San Francisco, another thing on that same note, we have one of the worst environmental justice scandals in the country. The last Black neighborhood in San Francisco, Hunters Point Bayview, has been poisoned by the U.S. Navy for decades. It's a cancer cluster. It has asthma rates through the roof. Nancy Pelosi never talks about it. People don't know what's happening. That community is getting no support from our federal government or our federal representation in government. And it's exactly the same pattern I'm talking about. Sorry, I just wanted to make sure that got
out. No, look, I mean, we're friends with Jordan Chariton. He can't get people to pay attention to the fact that the governor of Michigan should be in prison. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's like, nobody cares that we're poisoning people by the boatload.
More people basically need to be having a more well-oiled machine. Ben Ray Studio, thank you for your support. Does Indian Shahid would consider building or working with more local organizations in their cities to prepare for the run?
Oh, they both all do.
Well, whether they're running for office or not, I think that building a labor movement locally is essential for anybody who's involved in non-corporate politics, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. And I know, India, you could speak to this. I know that you're very involved with your local organizations. I mean, I think that's the whole key, right?
I'm an organizer. I was an organizer before I was a candidate. It's a natural fit for me. I mean, we have incorporated a new C4 specifically to run progressive candidates at the hyper local level. So, yeah.
That's What's awesome. It called? Shout it out. I want to follow it.
Yeah.
It's called Our City Action Buffalo, or OCAB, Our City Action Buffalo.
Put it up. Our City Action Buffalo. I like Buffalo.
And I just shout out the same thing. I agree. It's all about organizational building because that's what connects between electoral.
Is that .com, India?
I don't know. Just Google Our City Action.
Okay. Our City Action.
They're on Twitter and Facebook and all of that jazz too.
And
it might be a .org too. I'm just not quite sure.
That's right. And Shahid, I know how active you are with local organizations.
OurCityBuffalo.org. That's it.
There you go.
I was just going to shout a couple of them out. Youth versus Apocalypse and Extinction Rebellion are a couple of the climate justice organizations here that I see very much on the front line doing very consistent direct action. And yeah, proud to stand in solidarity with groups that are on the direct action side of the equation. I see a lot of organizations in San Francisco that do a lot of talking without walking their talk. And those are organizations to our prior conversation that I'm happy to spend a lot less time on.
Yeah, like we attend a lot of labor rallies. We would go to anytime there was a fight for 15 outside of a McDonald's or, we just went down and went and supported the Starbucks workers that are in Hialeah. And I don't ever see elected people, elected officials, local, state of any caliber at any of these rallies support. Actually, we saw Ken Russell, shout out to Ken Russell, who is a city commissioner, City of Miami. He is actually running for Senate against Marco Rubio. And he was at a fight for 15 rally. So I would like to say it. But for the most part, sitting officials don't ever show up for those people.
No, if you're a corporate, you only show up if you absolutely have to and if the machine tells you that you need to. That is why it is completely, again, it's a paper tiger in many ways. The one thing that they do have is an unbelievable amount of money and power. But the people fight for nothing. People showed up to Buffalo for India for nothing because they believe in what she's fighting for. People showed up for Shahid in San Francisco because they believe in what he's fighting for, not because they're getting paid. That is the distinct difference between what our side is doing. And I hate that this is a side, but really is. It's a corporate versus non-corporate side. Corporate politicians must pay up to stay in power. Mm-hmm. They cannot and will not ever be applicable to everyday people. As it stands now, they currently are in control, but my God, if we just take a moment to think about how much the narrative has changed in the last 5 years, I mean, think about where you guys are personally. Who would have ever thought that the three of you would have been running for, you know, state office and, or in this case, city office and federal office? I mean, that is a huge change.
I certainly didn't see it coming a mile away. Yeah, for sure.
Well,
can I ask you that, India? Did you see that as something in your path?
He's having a moment.
Well, I just wanted to thank both of you, India, Shahid. You're both doing a wonderful job, and I'm glad to see that I've inspired a lot of people. Jen, I think I inspired you too.
Of course.
For those of you that are here, make sure that you follow them on social media. Make sure that you subscribe to Generational Change. It's a great channel. Really good stuff.
Thank you.
And we really hope that you come back and see more of our shows because we've got a lot of interesting stuff to do. So you guys, you're doing great. Really appreciate you. Jen, sorry.
And you always do that.
That's the way I thought. That's okay. That's a Brooklyn thing. You understand. So thank you. Really appreciate you. Keep doing great.
Best Bernie impression, hands down.
It's good, right? The mask is creepy as hell, but the impression is really good.
Well, I mean, I can do the voice, but if I can put the face on, then people are like, wow, that really is Bernie.
Yeah, it's just, it makes him look like he's got really bad teeth.
Well, he doesn't.
No, I know he doesn't.
And I am fighting for people that have bad teeth so they can have
it's like a Bernie Austin Powers remix, sort of.
It is. It's just fun. He has a few of them that he do, but only when it's Bernie is it where I don't feel like I want to go like this. Because otherwise he does Trump and he does Bill Clinton and I'm always kind of like this.
We're totally coming back. Believe me when I tell you we're totally coming back.
Or, India, I think you're quite a charming lady. And if I could get away from Hillary for 5 minutes, I do have a private. Yeah.
It's gross. It's so lechy. And then he'll put on his... He'll put on his Biden mask and try to smell my hair.
That is our commander-in-chief, our sniffer-in-chief. Our sniffer-in-chief. But we have to be able to at least have moments of levity, because if we don't, our lives would be completely miserable. Lord knows we're trying to fight an uphill battle that could potentially be a lifetime's worth of work. But we know that if we continue to build these networks, if we continue to work together, continue to connect individuals, this is the first time you two have been connected, and we're extremely happy that we had the opportunity to do that. And so if you guys have anything that you want to plug, Shahid.
Hey, India, you're not running right now, right?
Don't drag her into this just yet. She don't need to get back in that fest. Shahid, what is your website so that people who want to follow your campaign can support?
Yeah.
Thanks for asking. We're online at shahidforchange.us or shahid.fyi on all the social media platforms at Shahid for Change. And we've got an FEC disclosure deadline looming at midnight East Coast time tomorrow. So grateful for the chance to connect with your listeners and eager to invite any support. And please do support the organization that India's launching in Buffalo too. It's that exactly that layer that we need to keep going in between electoral.
Yeah, I'm not launching. They did that. They I'm just supporting, shouting them out, and making sure.
Yeah,
it's great work that I would never take credit for.
Let's pass Medicare for All. That includes mental care, because let's face it, it is a mental weight times a million to be involved in this. Like, it takes a certain level of crazy.
No, this shit leaves marks.
Oh yeah.
Like it leaves marks, and I don't care how thick your skin is. It leaves marks. I am not on social media. I haven't been for over a year now. And the reason, and I'm fortunate because I have him and he handles that, because otherwise I would have to be on it, because you have to be on it in order to be functioning now. But I got to tell you, they're too mean. I'm sorry. I don't want that kind of toxicity in my headspace. I just don't. I don't need that crap, and I don't need people mean to me.
But let's be honest. The way that these sites are designed is for controversy, for arguments.
Oh yeah.
They want people to be involved in that, because that's what keeps people addicted. You know, when you look at your phone and you see that you've been on it for 8 hours, it's like you don't even realize how involved you are with all of this, and how the ability to decompress is so necessary, and how people are always looking at the ones that are willing to take on this responsibility and think, oh, how come you're not doing, or how come you're not? If you haven't done it yet, then you really don't have a leg to stand on. It's kind of like when people have an opinion about going to war and they would never bear arms to defend our country. I don't want to hear your opinion if you're not serving our country. So at the end of the day, what you guys doing is an absolute good. And it cannot be said enough. You are inspiring millions of people. It may not seem like it in the moment at times, but we are building a real movement here. And I can't wait to be able to chat with you guys again, and looking forward to all the amazing work that you're doing. And, you know, obviously we appreciate the kind words in regards to what we do. We all have a role to play. And
Indy, I still would love to see you run for something too, just because.
I would too, for the record.
I know. And
can you bother her in the fall?
No.
Let her get
at her convenience. It need not be soon. Take all the time you need.
Yeah, there's no hurry. You know, we're talking 24 here, because I knew this year was a wash, and our district hasn't even been drawn yet. So I knew that was a waste. But Indy, that is the kind of badassery that we need in like legislative offices.
I'll tell you what, and I'll tell you what,
that's exciting.
Whether she runs again, I think she will, but I will say this: if the Buffalo Bills, who will be favored to win the Super Bowl this year, they are one of the top five teams that are expected to potentially win. If they do end up winning the Super Bowl, I have no doubt that she'll be so exacerbated about everything that has taken place, you could probably talk her into running for president in the United States. But I'll digress.
No, but I would very much love that. And I think you know that power that you have, whatever that is that inspires, and you know that that has to be put out there. It just does. Like, it's like a shining light of, you just have to. And it's unfortunate that it sucks as much as it does. It shouldn't, but it does. But there are so many people that really do have your back. Like, you really are what is needed. You know, like, to me, you're like, it's like a Kashama Sawant thing. We need like a lot of those people all over the place. And that is how, and
And that is who India would have been. She would have been the next Kashama Sawant. And they had to put a stop to that.
Well, you can't have that. Well, look at how much money they spend against her. Look how much money Bezos puts up against Kashama.
Of course. Of course. But you know what? The people are on the side of good and not corporate power. It's just a matter of when, not if. India Walton, Shahid Buttar.
Thank you guys.
Thank
so
you
much.
Guys. We really appreciate it. And we hope to see you
soon.
Bye.
Bye, y'all. Keep up the great work.
Thank you. Well, they rocked.
They're lovely.
Yes, I would say so.
Well, I love her. She's adorable. And Shahid's great. And you know what? I get what he's saying because he does come off extremely intellectual because, you know, he's really smart.
He is.
So he doesn't need to go out and pretend to not be smart.
So was India. She's very sharp.
No, I just mean what he was saying, that he's often been affiliated
when you're
as
in
an elitist. When you're in San Francisco,
it's very tough to.
Right. Like, whereas Buffalo, it's a little bit different. Nobody's thinking of Buffalo as sort of like the academic elitist capital of the world.
So we do want to run through real quick our news and amuse, which we haven't done in a while.
Well, we haven't. And I'm not. I wish I was better prepared. That's why I sent them to you to some extent. So start with this, because that we know.
So Biden's new budget calls for increased funding of police and taxing billionaires. I don't know if this is supposed to be some type of a grand bargain of some sort. We're going to increase police funding, but we're going to tax the billionaires. Listen, this is, I don't know what they're hoping to get, but with the way things are these days and considering how knee-deep corporate President Biden is, there is no taxing of billionaires that's coming down the pike right now. We have to be completely honest about this. There's just no legislation that's going to be enacted. This is all nice. This is all like, oh, come on. You know, my God, let me show the people.
The problem with this is, of course, whatever headline I'm looking at, whichever interest group is putting out the news, it's going to focus on it. So there's the people that are focusing on the increased funding for the police. But then there's the people that are like, oh, he's talking about taxing billionaires. He must be really woke kind of mentality. And it's like, no, he's not at all.
My good friend Joel says that he's going to tax billionaires. And that's
no. And let's also talk a little bit about the war budget, because the war budget is now up to, my understanding is that $8 trillion over 10 years for the war budget, and the fact that Congress will likely even give him more, because they tend to do that. And I find that just unbelievably infuriating, people. The same people that are telling us we can't afford Build Back Better are supporting an $8 trillion war budget.
That's for sure. And so
that's just crazy, people.
No change is actually happening when you think about who actually is running this country. That is why when we hear
more
that Zelensky and Putin are really trying to get this finished and get some type of a negotiation done, our military industrial complex wants no part of that. They want this to last as long as humanly possible. Because we're sending them arms, they are making billions of dollars. That is how this works. So as long as they're not involved, that would be better. On a side note, President DeSantis vetoes new Florida congressional map and calls for special session. So when we say that he is going to drag this thing out probably till June, till the last possible minute, that is exactly what he's going to do. Yep. There is federal law in place where it has to be determined by, candidate declaration day. Or
it has to be done by the candidate qualification day, which is in June. I want to say it's
June
like
15th
June,
or something
June.
Like that.
So he technically has up until that time to actually set our district lines. Now, they have been set for our state offices. They just have not been set for our federal office.
Yeah. And that's what's going to happen. Unfortunately, this is what we have to deal with, and why anyone who is running for federal office in Florida this year, man, oh man, what a, I don't know what to say. I mean, look, I know people got to run for office, but it's like the odds of you beating an incumbent is slim to none. That's the reality. So speaking of which, there's never been such a shortage of homes in the U.S., and here's why. Well, one of the reasons that that is happening, as we know, is massive mega corporations like BlackRock are buying up as many homes as they can get their hands on. So I guess what they're trying to do is turn us into a renter's economy. Boy, talk about never having any ability to build wealth.
Well, and it isn't even just, it's what they're building. It's not that they're not building. Like when we go out here, all I see is development and building. Mm. It's all over the place. there's also a lot of empty things too.
So, right.
But I think this is also very state specific. Like, we don't necessarily have a housing shortage here. We just don't have affordable housing.
Correct.
So, but there are places that are actually having a literal housing shortage. We're not talking about just affordable housing. We're talking about just housing in general. And it's, by one estimate, the U.S. is more than 3 million homes short of the demand from would-be homebuyers. Pandemic-related supply chain problems aren't helping. So, you know, that, and I can attest to somebody who just recently sold and then bought a house. The cost of everything is so ridiculous right now. So you're not able to, people aren't able to afford to build the homes because the materials that are so out of control high. Steel has tripled in a year. Wood is up. Like, every type of material cost that you would use to build a home is so high right now. It isn't just pandemic related, but that's a lot.
Hey, but listen, they really made a great decision putting Mayor Pete in charge of transportation. That was a great choice, let me tell you. Oh boy, I can't wait for him to run for president again, because I would be running an ad pillar to post all day, every day about what a disaster that man is as our head of Department of Transportation. Here, if you think that he is not responsible for a chunk of what's going on right now, then you're a partisan hack.
Okay, so here's an interesting thing. So one of the things is that people want to build more attached townhouses or smaller homes on less land for, you know, that is more affordable. But in many places, zoning rules won't let you buy land and divide it up. And so you can only build one house with a big yard. So the way zoning is set up is really shocking.
They are creating tens of millions of underclass. That's what they're doing.
Yeah.
And it's deliberate.
Yeah.
And our government, because it is bought, isn't going to do anything. Because for them, it's all about them. My God. And, you know, one thing I didn't mention before, you know how Pelosi is allowing, you know, Thomas to skate and isn't going to try to prosecute, even though he should be thrown out of the Supreme Court?
That's not how that works.
I know. But I will say this. Do you think for one second, if there was a scandal involving Sotomayor, for example,
or Elena Kagan,
do you think if McConnell was in charge that he would not be doing everything in his power to try to get them thrown out?
Oh, of course.
Oh my God, he would be. He would. That would all. He would. That's all he would be focused on.
Right.
He'd be focused on that. So.
And but that's kind of a small potato problem, though. Quite honestly,
I would say
like, of all the reasons in the world.
Although, if you can make it a five, yeah, but if you can make it a 5-4 court, that would probably be a good thing. It would be a good thing.
So
I digress. So, Labor Department says U.S. job openings remain at historic highs.
Yeah, near record level in February. Little change from the previous month.
Why is that?
Well, wait, there were 11.3 million available jobs last month, matching January's figure and just below December's record. The number of Americans quitting their jobs was also historically high at 4.4 million, up from 4.3 million in January. So this is definitely a trend. And they're not liking that that people are waking up and don't want to work for slave wages anymore.
No.
And I do think that COVID exacerbated that sort of realization.
People are starting to realize that they have more power than they actually realize. And they are willing to live in co-op type situations until they get what they need, because companies have been screwing workers for decades and people are waking up and saying, I'm not taking this anymore. And if I have to sacrifice in the short term for long-term gain, and believe me, they are willing to sacrifice. They are willing to live like hermits and, you know, almost like in efficacy type situations if they have to, in order to get more bargaining power. That is absolutely commendable. And I don't
think we do have low unemployment, which to me is, you know, meaningless. I mean, I love people tout that as if that's some sort of number. Yes, because people are working multiple jobs in order to live. But I think a lot of it has to do with, and it is forcing employers to have to pay more money, which that to me is actually a demonstration of the market working. That to me, when people aren't willing to come work for your slave wages, so you have to give them more money to get workers, that's actually a functioning work system. That's how it's supposed to be. And if we actually had strong unions, then we wouldn't even need a minimum wage.
Mm.
That's my goal. My
Imagine
goal.
That.
Like, we shouldn't have to legislate a minimum wage. In places like Finland, there's no minimum wage. They have very strong labor unions that negotiate for fair wages. And quite honestly, they prioritize their workers in those countries.
And that's why it's a happy land.
So they don't need a minimum wage. You only need a minimum wage when the people in charge are trying to screw you. And so they have to be like legislatively forced to value their workers.
What do you want?
I don't want anybody lechy, but that's a big board. Oh, okay. Well, wait, but his glasses are awry.
My glasses. Fix my glasses, Jen. I can't see. So I just want to say we really appreciate you all coming on tonight. And we hope you enjoyed the show. It was a great show, a wonderful show.
And guys, check out patreon.com. If you haven't been
a supporter of the show as of yet, this is a great show. Jen, please blow that in the other direction. Patreon.com/generation generational change. If you want to support this great show, this is a really great show. So it really needs your help. $5 a month, 10 bucks.
Stick around and watch Bernie with a contact high.
25 bucks is a very generous support.
Oh, God, guys. And really, all the money from Generational Change goes to our 501c4. It is, we use that money to support all like local community service initiatives and also to support non-corporate candidates in the country.
You're doing a wonderful job. We really appreciate what you're doing. So, guys, go to patreon.com/generational change.
Yeah, support this wonderful show. $5 a month, guys.
You definitely could do it. It'll make a big difference for people locally. That's what I want to say. Goodbye.
Thank you, Bernie. I'd love to see Bernie with a good contact high. What do we have coming up? Because I don't really know. We don't have. You've been like working magic behind the scenes lately, like that doing stuff. I don't know what's going on. I feel very out of the loop. Our next show is on Monday, yes?
Our next show is Monday, as far as I know. But you have a very special show coming up tomorrow morning.
I do.
Jen is going into the lion's den tomorrow. She is going on Ben Shapiro's Daily Wire with Michael Knowles. That is going to be on at 9:20 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Now, I don't know for sure
what if this show is going to be that, live. It's a
the Michael Knowles show.
Michael Knowles show. What does Ben Shapiro have to do with this?
It's on the Daily Wire.
Oh.
Ben Shapiro owns the Daily Wire.
Okay. I'm like, I'm not going on with Ben Shapiro.
No, you're not going on with Little Man. You're not doing that.
I just don't. I don't think I'd be able to keep a straight face.
It's the yarmulke?
He's a caricature. He is. He's a caricature. I cannot take him seriously. Plus, nothing he says is any reason to it whatsoever, but he talks really fast, so people think he's smart.
I'm totally a smart guy, and I can definitely tell you that this is a great company that you want to spend money on. If you haven't invested in cybersecurity for your computer as of yet, you might want to do it today.
You know,
and I'm getting paid about $1,000 every time I say this, and I say it every day in front of the mirror. I recite it over and over again, and I sound really smart when I do it.
You know who I'd love? Like, if I could have like a, you know how you have like fantasy football. Like, if I could put together a really entertaining situation, I would love to put Ben Shapiro in a room with Christopher Hitchens for just a few minutes.
That made absolutely no sense whatsoever. You cannot convince me that I am not smarter than Christopher Hitchens.
I think it would be just very entertaining. I'm sorry. I just do.
Oh, maybe it will be. Hopefully you'll catch the show tomorrow. I don't know yet. I'll have to come up with something. I'm becoming very busy in my private life, so.
Your private? You mean your professional life?
Which is private. I'm not going to say about that. We hope you guys enjoyed it. Please share it. We know you, obviously, who are here tonight, despite Declan being here to trash us a little bit.
You know what, though? After we had some really mean troll that was here for a while that we got rid of, I actually don't mind Declan. I don't mind that. Guy Scat Muncher is harmless. Don't worry about that.
Yeah, it's all good.
Yeah, I've had enough people be mean to me to know that that's not a problem.
Yeah, that's definitely not something that I'm too worried about right now. So we hope you guys enjoyed. We will definitely see you on Monday. And remember, tomorrow, Jen is going on with Michael Knowles from The Daily Wire. Hope you guys enjoyed. See you soon.
Thanks for watching. If you want to support our mission to transform politics into service, please like this video, subscribe, follow us on social media, and consider joining our Patreon, where you'll get early access to our interviews as well as other exclusive content. Links are in the description. Peace out.